Alcoholic name Lauren. Hi, everybody.
Lots and lots and lots. Whole bunches.
Don't mind me, I'm starting my timer. All right. Yeah. Hi, everybody. There's a lot of echoing in the room here. Thank you for everybody that's here tonight. I'm going to keep my story brief. So I grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and I was a schoolaholic and a workaholic before I was an alcoholic. I always had those addiction kind of tendencies, right? Got to get straight A's, got to be in every single club at school, got to be in every sport you can think of possible, right? Got to please the parents, got to do this. But I'm the one that was setting those high bars for myself, right? And I originally wanted to go to medical school, so like all my academia was focused on that. My younger brother got into drugs and alcohol before I did. He got so bad with it that I was already in college at this point. He went down the K-hole from ketamine into drug-induced psychosis. So he was basically schizophrenic for about 2 years. And like I didn't know what to do or how to handle it. I didn't know what AA was yet at the time. If I had known about Al-Anon, I probably would have popped in. And at the same time, my mom was going through breast cancer treatment. I had just gotten a job right out of college working in a level one trauma center in the emergency room. So I would do all the chart documentation for physicians. So between my chaotic life at home, helping drive my mom for treatment, trying to figure out how I can help my brother, which honestly I couldn't at that point. The way I started drinking was, I'm a binger. Take a couple shots before I fall asleep at night, right? So I don't have to think about anything. I'll just pass out for the night. And then slowly and slowly, it's like 2 shots at night, 3, 4, 7. I'm going to work with my hands doing this. And I realized immediately, like I knew it was an alcoholic from the beginning. I would see alcoholism in the emergency room. And I always thought to myself, oh God, I'm never gonna wind up like that guy. The guy that comes in that's orange, you know, basically yellow, orange colored, they call that jaundice from liver failure. So yeah, no, I'm never gonna do that. But the shaking got so bad at that job, I quit because I didn't want to be found out, right? At one point I thought, like, someone's got to smell this on me because I'm coming into work sweating and detoxing while I'm there, right? So when I quit, all this money I had saved up from working 2 jobs all through college to go to medical school, start applying, you know, for said interviews, etc., I spent it on alcohol. I was still trying to pay for my own apartment, hiding it from my family. They really didn't know how bad it was until age 27. I wound up in the hospital 12 times that year from binge drinking. I remember one of the social workers talking with me. Like, both my parents were there at this point. And he's like, your blood alcohol content was 585. Do you know how high that is? And I was like, what do you mean? It's like blowing a point, you know, 5.8. And I'm awake. So I'm making a crack and a joke, like, oh, I guess I can drink a Russian under the table. But that social worker looks me dead in the eye, and he goes, are you proud of that? Ouch. I knew I needed help, I just didn't know what to do. So in desperation, I started calling different insurance companies, like, hey, where can I go? But what's the farthest place I can get away from Pennsylvania? Because my parents were still enabling me, right? They're letting me live at their house and drinking like I'm doing and just winding up in the hospital. And my brother's mental health deterioration, my mom luckily had finished treatment at the time, and I was like, I just need to get out of here. So California sounded nice. I was like, I'm going to go to Palm Springs. Came out here for treatment. I was at a small facility that ended up getting shut down by the FBI for fraud, for insurance fraud. Yeah. And then I was like, all right, now I got to get in, do sober living or what. I don't know what to do yet. Started going to AA, but I only went to meetings. I stayed sober for about a year, 3 months. And I was dry. I didn't work the steps. So subsequent, you know, I drank. And I just remember coming back in as a newcomer, like, oh, God, here we go again. And I saw what you guys had, and I didn't know how to get it. I saw that, like, happy, joyous, free look in people's eyes and the laughter, and I was just miserable. So I was in and out of AA for about 2 years. And then my bigger relapse happened where I was at work. I called in sick, but I've never done that before, just so suddenly. None of my colleagues knew where I lived at that point. I didn't tell anybody I had a history of alcoholism. I was just like hiding it, right? But I didn't show up to work the next day either, and the day after that. And they're like, we need to call sheriff's department on her or something. She's not answering her phone. You know, what's happening? And then I went into treatment for the second time, and this was at Hemet Valley Recovery Center. Met some really nice friends there. And, you know, not everybody stays sober. Around my 1 year mark after that treatment center, I had a best friend, his name was Ben, that was in the program with me, was found dead in his bed at Sober Living from drugs and alcohol. And that was my first, like, oh my goodness, like, this is what happens when we don't get it. It's going to take us out. And then for that sobriety, I had about 4 years. And close to my second year of that sobriety, I met somebody in AA in the program. He was doing the deal like me. We hit it off. His name was Tim. And this was like, I'm going to marry him, we're going to get engaged, like the whole nine yards, right? We're planning on moving in together. And he also was a transplant, so he came from Washington down to California to get sober. His mom was a snowbird, so she had a place here and then back in Washington. And he was also in the same line of work as me. So he ended up having a freak accident where I literally had this terror cat. I've never met a cat in my life that would just, like, you walk past his bed and she'd scratch your feet, like I'm nosediving to get on his bed to get away from his cat. He ends up tripping over her in the bathroom, and he had a prior meniscus tear in his shoulder, so he didn't put his arm down. And he cracked a couple ribs on the side of the tub. So I was like, all right, well, you need to go get an x-ray. You got to figure this out. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'll be fine. And then after about a week, he calls me. He's like, hey, I can't breathe all the way in, like, in all the way. And my brain's like, from working in a trauma unit, I was like, oh, my God, he's got a pneumothorax. Like, his ribs probably punctured his lungs, right? I was like, you get to the hospital, you tell the nurse all of your symptoms, that you cracked ribs, that you can't breathe, right? Or you're going to be sitting there 9 hours. I'm like, this is an emergency. And sure enough, when they brought him in back, he had what was called a hemopneumothorax. So his lung filled up with blood. So he had to have an immediate surgery with the cardiothoracic surgeon. They had to excavate some of the tissue. Now, this is all, like, right before COVID. So this was February 2020. And he was there for a solid week. I brought him home. It was a Sunday. I was like, do not pick up anything. I'm going to go get your cat litter delivered. I'm going to pick up groceries. Like, you can't do anything strenuous. Because he even had this little apparatus they called a spirometer, you have to breathe to start rebuilding your lung capacity. So Monday, I brought him home Sunday night. Monday, I didn't hear from him in the morning, and I was like, oh, God, he's sleeping. You don't get any rest at the hospital, right? So I'm going, and I'm buying groceries. I'm getting the cat litter delivered. And his sister calls me later in the evening. She's like, hey, I haven't heard from Tim. And then I was like, oh, okay, so that's not good. And then his mother calls me. I haven't heard from Tim all day. So at this point, I'm like, I got to go check on him. And I had a key to his apartment at that point. So I show up to his apartment complex. The cat litter that said it had been delivered for hours was still sitting there. And then that internal feeling of dread that you get when you know something's about to happen, like, came over me. Because I opened the front door, and his cat's looking all bewildered, staring at me. And I was like, hey, Tim, you know, yelling to him. And then I look down the hallway, and I see his legs dangling off the bed. So I walk in that back room, and he was face down on the mattress, dead. And I knew he was dead for hours because he was already blue, like he was rigid. And I'm calling 911. I was like, hey, can you just send the coroner? Like, I went into this like disassociation mode, like, oh, that's a patient. I'm going to help like get all this facilitated. I mean, I just didn't know what to do in the moment other than that. Police came, whole investigation, didn't find anything. And I'm so happy, my sponsor at the time, after I found him, I called 911, I rang her phone, and I was like, hey, Tim's dead. She lives 5 minutes from his apartment complex. She was just about to turn her phone off to go to sleep. Just about to turn it off when I called her. And she came and sat there with me before the coroner even showed up. So I was like, everything was beyond me, but all I knew what to do was to like do the next indicated step. And I showed up to my meetings, right? I showed up to my women's meeting the next day, and I'm crying my eyes out. Like, I'm still in like, is this really happening right now kind of mode. And then I went to my meeting the next day, and I shared about it, and the next day, and the next day. And I don't know how I stayed sober through that, but because I did, I got to find a really good home for his cat. Because I had three at the time. I was like, I can't take another one. I was able to help his mom and his sisters clean his apartment out. So then I kept some mementos from him. But I got this brilliant idea where I'm going to go start over now. It's like, I'm just done with California, right? So I pick up and I move to Washington State against my sponsor's advice, right? Because, like, you bring you with you. And I had this unresolved trauma that just happened with me where I'm just like, see ya. So I ended up getting into a very toxic relationship in Washington. This guy was, oh my God. So he was a narcissist. You know how they do like a love bombing to you, right? Wheel you in. You should move in with me. We're going to get married. The whole nine yards. And I'm just like, sure. Because I'm not emotionally there, right? And they say that when your mental health's not all there, you attract like in somebody else, like similarities, right? Because he wasn't all there. he gaslit me. He was emotionally abusive. When he started punching walls, I was like, shit, I gotta get out of here because I'm next. So I ended up like, I'm gonna go back to California. Like, I made a community here of friends where I was just like, what was I doing? Why did I leave? I'm going to come back to my safe haven. So I did. And thank God I had started to go through like my steps again, because my sponsor, Marie, also helped me figure out how bad this guy was. So I had a colleague fly out from Minnesota to come, when I finished packing, drive with me and like leave, because like, I didn't know what this guy was going to do. So I felt safe, like she came and we drove back down to California. And it was a big help to have a friend too when you've got your cats in the car and a ton of items. So it was like a 2-day trip back. And when I got back here, what does my alcoholism do? I'm going to get a new job. So I'm going to earn more money. And then I turned into a workaholic, right? So I got this position where it was salaried, but I was on call. So I'm getting calls at 9 in the evening when I'm out at a sober dance, like, hey, can you run these meds by me with this patient coming in tomorrow? The website phone number was linked to my phone, so I'm getting a call at 3 in the morning, like, with somebody that's intoxicated. And I'm like, I need to shut off the phone. I can't take those kind of calls. Like, it was just too overbearing. And with unresolved trauma, and lack of therapy, my mental health just deteriorated, like, big time. I've had depressive episodes before, but, like, this one was it. So I owned a Sig Sauer P238. I loaded that thing with hollow points. And I said I was done. I can't take life anymore. And as an alcoholic, what did I do? Like, I had 4 years of sobriety at this point. What did I do? I got a bottle of vodka so I didn't have to feel it when I would shoot myself, right? And this is another God shot where I, because I'm a binge drinker, right? So I blacked out. I came to really sick. So I'm thrown up in my toilet, and I look over at my sweet little cat. This little orange cat named Cheddar. And he's looking at me like, hey, Mom, go get help. And I had just enough of this little, like, mustard seed of hope to say, you know what? I packed a couple items. I called an Uber. I got to the hospital, and I 5150'd myself. So I was in a psychiatric facility for about 6 days. I don't know if you all have ever been in one. It is not fun. Like, that's not, it's not the epitome of, like, stable individuals. So but I also got to see how things were worse. Like, there's this poor guy that was there that his 19-year-old daughter found him in his bathtub because he slit his wrist. And I'm sitting there talking with him, having lunch, and then just the blood still, like, oozing from the wounds, right, that were wrapped up. Or this sweet little 16-year-old girl that was my roommate that had ligature marks on her neck. So it was like a wake-up call for me, right? I didn't want to be there. But since I also, like, dipped out on everybody, people were like, where's Lauren? So the sheriff's department got called on me. People were, like, texting me, calling me, where are you? You're not at your meetings. No one heard from you. I call my job when I'm there on, like, the second day, and I was, like, director of admissions. So they're like, yeah, so you can't come back here after that. This is a substance abuse program I worked at. And then I got out, and I was like, great, now what? I had this, like, mentality of, thank you. I had this mentality of I need to get help. So finally did some PTSD therapy. I got on antidepressants because, like, sometimes you just need outside help, right? And I got through it. And then God was like, hey, so I'm going to give you another little bump in the road here. So 2 months after I'm getting therapy, I find a lump in my left breast. And it turned out to be stage 2 breast cancer. So I'm, like, newly sober again, and I was like, holy moly, what do I do now? I just remember after the physician told me on the phone, I'm standing in my kitchen, I call my sponsor, and I was like, hey, can you come here? And I don't remember the rest of that day. But I knew what I had to do, and that's stick with my women friends, go to these appointments, call the insurance company. Like, I wouldn't have gotten the treatment I did in such a quick amount of time if I were drunk. Right? I was like, pedal to the metal, let's go. Had a double mastectomy May 8th, breast reconstructive surgery September 8th, had a full hysterectomy this past February, and cancer-free. Yeah. I'm cancer-free, which is amazing. I have over 20 months of sobriety. And I just want to say how I did that was going to meeting, working my steps again, calling my sponsor. I have 2 beautiful sponsees now who I'm helping walk through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm involved in service commitments. I'm on Dickey Paw, Desert Young People of AA, right? I go to conventions. I go to service meetings. I'm the young people chair for District 9 at the area service level. I'm just in it. And I know I need to be in it to maintain what I'm doing now. So there's that phrase, like, trust God, clean house, and help others. I finally feel, like, at peace with myself. And I know I can handle anything that life throws my way, right? Because, holy moly, it would just be cancer. So the hair is new because that was a present to myself to, you know, since I beat it, the blue hair, and I'm looking for my next job now, now that I'm healthy. Hopefully it'll be in another like helpful capacity in healthcare. And I just got to keep praying. I'll find the right thing. And yeah, there's my timer. Perfect. Perfect. Yeah, I just want to say I'm grateful to be here. I'm happy I'm alive. I'm happy all of you are alive because we've been through the thick of it, right? We're blessed to be here right now. And the God of my understanding that I pray to every morning tells me that too. You have a purpose in life and you need to go forth with that. I really don't know what it is just yet, but I know I'm going to do it. And I just want to share my experience, strength, and hope with everybody that if you can get through cancer sober, like you can get through anything sober, anything. So, yeah, I'm grateful to be here. Thank you so much for asking me to speak. And I really appreciate everybody. So I love you all. Thank you.
All right, our next speaker is Bo M. from Palm Desert, California.
Bo alcoholic.
Bo.
Oh, forgot about that.
Lots and lots and lots.
Thank you so much. Feels so good. Yeah, it's nice you guys are doing that. A little taste of what they do at young people's conferences. So thank you. Lauren, thank you for your share. And yeah, I don't know. I was really nervous today. I mean, it's not all the time. How long am I speaking for?
40 minutes.
40 minutes. It's not often I speak for 40 minutes about me. Actually, once, one other time I did. And there was maybe like five people at the meeting. So there's not that many people here. So yeah, I was really nervous, and I ate a bunch of tacos to make me feel better. I should have just meditated, though, because now I have a tummy ache. No, it's really awesome I get to do something like this. You know, if there's one thing I learned in this program and in this sobriety is that I built a new life for myself through doing things I don't want to do, through walking through fear, and so here I am. So thank you, Taylor, for asking me to do this. Love you much. I will. I like to start with this, and kind of an analogy that I love to say. And for me, it feels like everyone, when they're born, is microchipped and programmed with answers. How to be happy, how to be successful or comfortable in your own skin. And my chip broke. And ever since I can remember, it felt like I was looking for answers. And I didn't know it at the time. I mean, it just felt like a normal life. But I know, looking back on it today, that's exactly what it was. It was a constant search for answers, for some solution. And I would say the first thing that I found was maybe music and things and women. And I mean, sports was a big thing for me. I played hockey growing up, and I know when I stepped on the ice, I could be somebody else other than myself. When I played music in a band, and it felt like I could be somebody else, you know. I didn't have to be who I was. And yeah, so it was always this constant search, and I moved around a lot when I was younger, but, you know, nothing too traumatic happened to me. It just felt like life was traumatic on its own. Like my own head was making things traumatic for me. And but my family loved me as much as they could. And you know, we were, I had a roof over my head and food, and, you know, so it, my brain would always just go in circles of like, why do I feel this way? You know, I had no reason to. But yeah, it was a constant search, and it, I remember that that first girlfriend I had, that's when I knew something was wrong with me. And my way of thinking was faulty. I was 16, and oh man, I was in love. Like, she was the one, right? And but just the way that relationship consumed me and distanced myself from everyone around me, and really I was just not able to function. Like, this is kind of like me describing how, kind of like those alcoholic tendencies before I ever drank or used. And I maybe had taken a couple sips of beer by this point, but I hadn't really drank yet. And anyways, that girlfriend left me, and or her whole family, I caused a lot of wreckage, and her whole family ended up moving away. And yeah, it was a mess. I won't get into that too much, but my life was over. I stayed in my room for 2 months straight, and I remember I went to my friend's grandma's place. I was living here in Palm Desert, and she had this bottle of Grey Goose vodka, and I filled up a cup and poured a little cranberry juice, and I chugged it, and I guess I would say it was like my first spiritual experience. Like, I like to say that it felt like I could breathe for the first time. It was very clear that up to that point, I was restless, irritable, and discontent all the time. And then finally, I had found a solution that worked. And I remember sitting there on the floor, just like bawling and telling my friends about, you know, my relationship or the girl that just left me. And I was finally able to express my emotions, but still feel so content with it. Like, I was just so content, just sitting there crying. And I was drunk. Nothing else mattered. And for me, it was right from the start. It was all the time, every day, as much as I could. I wanted to drink. I felt better when I was drunk, so I drank. I remember my dad had a liquor cabinet, and I'd go and fill up water bottles. It was like every Sunday night I'd stock up for the week, for the school week. So, and I'd fill like the whiskey I'd put in like darker bottles so no one could see it, and then the vodka in the white water bottles. And I just drink them in class at school. And I drank all day, every day, all the time. And I never thought twice, like, maybe a 16-year-old shouldn't drink this much. But like I said, I liked it better when I was drunk. I thought that was the solution, you know. This is working. I'm going to do it. And what comes along, I guess, with getting fucked up all the time is, like, you start being attracted to those people. So I'm hanging out with people that just like to get fucked up, and then found weed, and I liked weed. I mean, I had a stint with that, and where I was just a stoner, just smoking weed 24/7 from when I woke up to when I went to bed, and that was my identity for a bit. And I noticed it was, I mean, I tried every drug under the sun, and it seemed like I'd have stints with each one. Like, I'd have that spiritual experience like I first did when I drank, of that, wow, this is the solution. And then I'd use it as much as I could, and then it would stop working the way I wanted it to, and then I'd go to the next. And after that, it was like party drugs and all that, and then opiates, and then heroin, and then heroin and meth and IV, and that was my thing. That's what I did for the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking and using. And I know I do AA, I'm an alcoholic. I like to say I treated my alcoholism with heroin and meth. That's just what I did. But I mean, I didn't know what I was getting myself into, you know. I mean, I thank God for that today, you know, for doing those things and allowing me. Maybe that helped me to get here sooner. You know, I got sober when I was 21, and now I'm very grateful for all those times. But I am lucky to be alive today, that's for sure. I can never forget that. But so I'll talk a little bit about kind of the end of my drinking and using career and when I got here. It seemed like from ages maybe 19 to 21, I had tried every way imaginable of trying to get sober. Maybe even before that, when I was younger, trying just therapy. That was like the start. But I was really high, so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't doing anything. I remember, and then I tried this, like, counseling. It was actually the methadone clinic, but I was the only one there on Suboxone. So I thought, like, no, that's good. I'm doing good, you know? Like, look at all these people, and look at me, you know? I'm doing great, and I would do counseling, and but once again, I was using something the whole time. I was always using something. Was very against going to an inpatient treatment at the time. I mean, what, I was 19, and I still had a little bit of more experience to be had, I guess, and I wasn't that desperate yet. And I tried just the sober living. I tried that. That didn't work. I finally ended up going to an inpatient. I went to the ranch in Desert Hot Springs, and I don't know. I'm so grateful for the ranch because it's a part of my journey. I didn't stay sober. I went there twice. I did not stay sober after going there. The first time at the ranch, I got loaded every single day I was there. I have no idea, but I, in rehab, I could not stay sober a single day. And maybe I wasn't ready yet, I don't know. But, I mean, apparently I wasn't. So I had a little bit more experience to be had, yet again. I learned about meth when I was at the ranch, so that was good for that, I guess. No, I once again, thank God for that, because it brought me down quick. And I remember, I don't know, I was like selling drugs or doing whatever and living with my codependent dad. And, you know, I had everything I thought I wanted. I had all the drugs and all the money, and I was working. And but I remember being so miserable, like an unbelievable amount of misery. Like, I have no idea how I made it out of that alive. But in that time, overdosing maybe 3 times, you know, my dad coming in, finding me. I was using Xanax as well. That's one hell of a drug. And anyways, I made it into the ranch one more time, and this time I thought I had been through enough, and I thought I was going to give this a try. And I remember my mom had brought someone, because she does CODA and she knows AA people. She brought someone in to, like, kick down the bathroom door. I was, like, hiding in the shower, and he picked me up by the back of my shirt, dragged me down to his car. I remember that, because I was like 50 pounds soaking wet, and he brought me into treatment. So I went and I tried it again, and this time I was really gonna try. You know, I ended up staying sober for 2 months that time, and stayed the entire time at the ranch, the entire 2 months. And I was miserable, man. I was so miserable. Maybe it was all the weird drugs I was doing, and it just took a while to detox, but I was not willing to do any of the work. You know, I just wanted to lay down all the time. Like, whenever everyone was going to groups or meetings, I would just go hide and go lay down. When we were doing some workshop, I'd go hide and go lay down. We did the ranch projects where we had to do work around the property. I was not doing that either, I'll tell you that. And I wondered why I was so miserable, you know. But I definitely thought I still knew what was best. And anyways, I graduated the ranch. I left, and the next day I went to the NA conference in Palm Springs. Still sober. I mean, it had only been a day after I left the ranch. And I ended up meeting a girl, and she was loaded, and then it was on. End of story. I never really used with a girl like that before, so I had to try. No, ultimately, I still had more experience to be had, and that started a year-long stint of using. At this point, none of my family would talk to me. Losing most of my friends, definitely couldn't get a job. I was homeless. I ended up being homeless for about a year out here, staying wherever I could, getting kicked out of every Motel 6 in the valley. Me and this girlfriend that I had at the time, and man, it was miserable. And you know, you can just imagine everything that comes along with being homeless. And in that time, in and out of jail 7 times, and that's pretty impressive. I have no idea how that even happened, but I would just constantly keep getting arrested and then released to some drug program, and then I'd be back in before I can even sign up. And you know, once you're on probation and homeless, they just see me walk around the streets. They're like, "Yep, you know, come on, let's go. Know you got drugs on you." So towards the end of the homeless career, it was starting to be pretty miserable and starting to get to the point where I didn't want to be here anymore. I didn't want to be on this earth anymore. I thought I had tried every different way imaginable of trying to get sober, and nothing had worked. I thought I was doomed. And I remember I got arrested. The last time I got arrested, I just told the story the other day. It's funny. Someone was asking about it. At Bristol Farms, I was stealing alcohol and selling to some Mexican restaurant. I think you were there, too. I remember that. That's funny. Yeah, this, like, 400-pound dude sat on me and until the cops came. And I was just done, though. I had these one pair of pants, and they were ripped from my crotch all the way down to my ankle. And I was just sitting there, just like I'm so done living like this. And I went to jail that last time, and I got the shit beat out of me a lot. And I'll just say that. And it just really helped. It was like God trying to punish me, like, wake the fuck up is really what it was. And thank God for that, too. I ended up staying there for about 3 weeks in Banning, in the jail. And I remember my mom had gotten, like I said, she knows some people in AA, and she had gotten somebody to volunteer to come with her to pick me up from jail because he was sober. Maybe he'll talk to me, you know. He ended up sitting with my mom in the jail parking lot for 6 hours, and just to have a chance to talk to me for the 30-minute drive home. And don't remember anything that he said. I ended up using shortly after that, but I will say that there was something about that. There was something about the act of somebody doing something like that for nothing. Like, my mom didn't pay this guy to come with her, you know. He was doing that because he's sober and he genuinely wanted to help. And it must have hit me a certain way. I ended up actually getting sober about maybe 3 weeks to a month after that, and I've still been sober till today. And that guy ended up sponsoring me for a bit too. And anyways, towards the end, I stole the last bit of stuff from my mom that I could, traded it to the dope man. This was it. I wasn't going to live after this time. I was really wanting to die at this point. And I remember I kept waking up, just kept coming to. And luckily, I was blessed with an opportunity to get into treatment one more time. And I really didn't think it would work. I didn't want to stay sober. I couldn't even fathom staying sober. That I just knew I couldn't live the way I was living anymore, and I needed to try something. And really my thought was, I'll clean up and I'll get a job, I'll get my girlfriend back, I'll be able to support myself, and then I'll drink and use on the weekends or just better. That was my thought. Even after everything I just told you, and that's how we think, though. I can still do this, you know? I can try it better, or, you know, I don't know. But there was something different about this time. I definitely had a desperation I didn't have before. And the beginning I willed myself of just not wanting to be where I was at, not wanting to feel like how I felt leaving jail that last time. It really willed me through the first few months. But I was still not willing to work any steps. I mean, it took me a few months. I got sent off to this long-term transitional living in Arizona and in Prescott, Arizona. And it was very strict. It was like an AA boot camp, and everything was structured from 5:30 in the morning to 10 p.m. at night every single day. And but it was like a sober living, and you know, you're out in the real world, and they're just teaching you how to live a new life, and that was cool. I just wasn't willing to do any of it, you know. We would have to go out and look for jobs, and you'd have to come with a list of 20, I don't even know how many, it was a lot, maybe 20 to 30 places that you applied to, and I would just go to the park and sleep, because that's what I knew how to do. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to work at McDonald's, you know. I was too good for that, don't you know who I am? And funny story, I ended up working at McDonald's, but I'll get to that. I was unwilling to do anything, any of the rules, any of the chores. I knew what was best. That wasn't going to help me stay sober. I want to stay sober so bad that I don't need to do anything you tell me. I'm just going to stay sober. And I ended up getting kicked out of that treatment center, and this one place is this one guy was running a facility, and he's like, you can stay here for 3 days. If you do everything we tell you, you can stay here. And, you know, I was on the verge of being homeless in a different state now. I still have nothing. I have no possessions. I'm still lost, you know, but I'm about 3 months sober. And, I remember that they had they called it circle, but it was really just a hot seat for me. And they told me the truth, you know. It was, you know, young guys in the program with time that had been here before me, and they told me that I was doing it wrong, and this is how we do things here. And I kind of started to get what he was saying, you know. I remember him telling me, he asked me about my first step and if I was powerless. I was like, yeah, dude, I'm powerless over everything. And then I remember him asking me, what's the second part to that? I had no idea, you know. Basically that I couldn't manage my own life, and I wasn't realizing that that's exactly what I was doing. I thought I could still manage my own life. And I may have said otherwise, but my actions showed that I still thought I could manage my own life. And I started to realize that's exactly what I was doing. But what really got me is he started talking about this new life that he had created for himself through this program. Kind of like you said in the reading, being rocketed into the fourth dimension, and he's kind of floating through life and the happiest he's ever been and all this, you know, all the good stuff. And I remember in that moment sitting there, and that's, I believe, the magic of this program. For some reason in that moment, I believe this guy was like me and something had worked for him. And I couldn't explain it. Like, I'd never felt that way before. And I guess that was kind of like my first and second step. I came to believe that this had worked for this guy. Like, something's working. There's no reason he would take all this time and say all this stuff to me if he truly believed in something. He had a message with depth and weight, and I heard it and I felt it. And really, from that point on, things started to change. I felt like I finally understood my true first step and second step, and I made a decision at that point to turn my will and my life over, and I was finally starting to understand, like, the only thing you have to change is everything, and it was my way of thinking. But that was really the start of me just getting into the steps, and I found a sponsor and started just doing everything he told me to do. And I remember in the beginning, it was like a two-step kind of thing. It was just pray, do the next right thing. Pray, do the next right thing. Pray, do the next right thing. Like, that's what my brain consisted of. Nothing more. And I want to talk about God a little bit. When I found out I had to do this, I started reading through the Big Book again. And so thank you. You know, thank you, Taylor, for having me do this. So I was able to pick up the book again. I mean, it's amazing. It hits me different, like, almost every single time. And mainly the doctor's opinion, because I feel like reading that the first time was really when I started to feel something. And then We Agnostics, too, that was really sticking with me this time I read it. But, man, I hated the word God. I hated higher power and God and organized religion. I was so against all of that growing up. And I don't know if I really have my own experience with a God or higher power, but I knew I hated it, and people who believed in God were weak. That's just what I thought. And I think finally at a point of desperation and open-mindedness, I was able to give it a try, you know. I remember my sponsor telling me, just pray with sincerity, like you mean it. And I had never prayed before, so I had no idea what that even looked like. Like, I saw people doing it in jail. I was like, they seem to enjoy it. Uh-huh. Like, I'd do it with them and just pretend, you know. I go to the church services just for something to do, you know. But I think that last time in jail was the first time I started to notice. I started to notice this guy praying, and just, there was something about him, you know. He had faith. That's something I didn't understand before. I didn't even realize it. But living a life of faith And that's definitely something I didn't realize playing God my entire life. Like thinking there's nothing else out there but me. I'm the center of the universe, and you know, I make the decisions, I control everything, and the funny thing is nothing ever goes my way. You know? This line that out of the We Agnostics, which has stuck with me, is our ideas didn't work, but the God idea did. And I really like that, and it talks about the God idea, right? It says that a lot in that chapter. And I remember trying to think of what God is, like a person, place, or thing, but it's an idea. It's a way of life. And it's a way to get into faith. And the way it was describing it to me, it just really started standing out. And especially in the doctor's opinion, when I finally understood, wow, I'm an alcoholic. Like, I started reading the doctor's opinion and thinking, like, my problem's just heroin and meth. I'm like, I don't understand what AA has to offer me. But I started reading the doctor's opinion, looking for things I could relate to and things that stood out. And I want to say a similar experience like I did when I was using all those drugs for the first time, or when I drank for the first time. It was that aha moment of, holy shit, I'm an alcoholic. That's what it felt like. And that sense of relief that, wow, if this truly feels like me, maybe this will work. And that was the first time I started to feel that sense of maybe there is something that will work. And I continued through the steps and did my inventory, and wow, I mean, this may just be a thing for alcoholics, but I know for myself, like, the scariest thing on planet Earth is taking a look at yourself. Like, end of story. Seeing the truth. I don't want to see it. I don't want to see how I was thinking or how I felt about all these people. And I will say I probably had the most amazing shift after doing a four-step. I had the most amazing spiritual experience, I would say. Just seeing my diseased mind on paper, that way I was living my entire life up to that point, and just knowing that that's not the person I want to be anymore. I was just, everything was, my entire life was based off of fear. Everything I did, everything I said, everywhere I went, it was all fear. And I was tired of living that way anymore. And then I did my fifth step, and we went on top of a mountain. It was so awesome. And I sat up there for an hour after. Well, I made it like 40 minutes after the fifth step. And just thinking of this new person that I wanted to create. And I had God's help there with me. And at that point, I had started building this connection with what I call God, but just a higher power. But it was very clear at that point I had tapped into something. I had tapped into a source of power that was filling me up. You know, it was filling me up like all those drugs and alcohol did, like all the women and the jobs and the things, all the things. But this power was everlasting. I can't overdo it, right? It's not gonna cause harm to me and everyone around me. This is a power that's going to help me put good into the universe and make me feel good and connected with everyone and everything. And it's, I mean, probably the reason why I'm standing here with 11 years sober, you know. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Like, I couldn't even stay sober a day in rehab. And I've been sober for 11 years, and it's with yeah. Thank you. With relative ease too, and not to boast about it, but I mean, that's a direct result of this program. And I've tapped into a source of power that is keeping me full, that has removed my desire to drink or use again. How much time do I got? Oh, perfect. I'll tell the story about, because I remember the exact moment that I knew, I want to say I knew I lost the desire to drink and use. I had saved my using kit that I was using with. For my first 3 months I was sober. I forgot about it, but I kept it with me in rehab, and I kept it like hidden in this secret compartment in my suitcase, just in case, you know. You never know. And it was right after this time where I realized my true first and second step, and I was thinking about really giving it a shot. So it was about like 3 months sober, and I had a really bad day, and I don't even know what happened. You know, we just have bad days. And I remember sitting in my room alone, and I remembered. I was like, oh, my shit's still in my suitcase. I'm going to go get loaded. I'm sure there's enough in there. I've been sober for 3 months. I'll feel something. And I pull it all out, and I just stare at it for like about 10, 15 minutes. And this overwhelming feeling came over me of, it's not gonna work. Like this, it's not gonna work for me. It's not gonna make me feel better. And then I started playing the tape through of, what's gonna happen after that, you know? And that had never happened to me before. And it was at that moment I realized, holy shit, something's working. You know, something's working. I don't understand it. I got scared and I went. I put it all away. I threw it out, the stuff out, like the next day or something. But I put it down. I went and laid in bed, and I went to sleep. And that was the first time that it happened since I started drinking and using. And man, I never looked back. I haven't had the desire to drink or use since that day. It's just, for me today, it's no longer a solution to anything that I'm going through. It's only ever going to make things worse. I have a solution today. And I don't know about tomorrow. I don't know how I'm going to feel a few years from now. But I know today, drinking or using is not a solution for me. And that's ingrained into my being today. I'm a sober person, you know, and I have tools, and I know, I don't like saying, I'm going to not say that, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I have to stay humble, and I realize I've 11 years sober, I still don't know what I'm doing half the time, I promise. I have worked through the steps, and I still have a sponsor, and it's awesome. We go and speak at the ranch where I went a few times. We go every month, and that's an awesome experience. I get to share with them every month, and I have sponsees right now. I've been working way too much and haven't been going to enough meetings, but I'm so grateful that I get to do something like this. It helps me to get reconnected and gives me that juice again for sobriety that I've been missing, because I've been out living life. You know, I get to, I work with kids today. Like, what? They did, I got hired for this government program, and they did this intensive background search, and I was so scared. And I when I got here, I had 6 felonies and owed tens of thousands of dollars to the courts, and now I only have 2 felonies. But no, they only look back 7 years. And, you know, I was in the check fraud system for 7 years. I couldn't have a bank account. I paid off all my court fines. I made amends to everyone I needed to on my initial list. I continued to take inventory and continue to work through the steps. And I don't know, the AA has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. Not everyone's going to have the same experience as me, but I just hope that everyone has just a little bit of the experience I did, you know, because it was truly amazing. It gave me a life beyond my wildest dreams. I was able to press the reset button. It feels like I lived two separate lives. It's really cool. That's all I have, I think. Yeah. Okay.
Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12stepTapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12stepTapes.com for more information.